If I entrusted you with a key to our home while we go away on vacation, what do I expect of you? I expect you to leave it the way you found it, right? You will be in my space, but will not abuse my space. That's the rule. And when I return, all my possessions will still be there. And what I expect is that you're not going to screw things up, right? You're not going to go about re-alphabetizing my CDs and my books. You're not going to eat all the food in the freezer. Like, the food in the fridge will go bad, but don't eat the food in the freezer. That's still good stuff. And none of my stuff is going to show up on eBay, okay? I entrust you to maintain my home as you found it. If I entrust you with my children for the evening, well, that's a little bit more interesting, perhaps. There's a long list of don'ts, like don't let them stay up too late or get into things we both know they shouldn't. And there's a long list of do's, like respect them and keep them alive. How about that one? But truly, entrusting you with my children amounts to don't screw it up and don't screw them up. Entrusting you with my money, my health, my well-being, is that any different? I mean, in substance and emotion, sure, but in every other way, I give you my trust, and in everything, that expectation is mostly just don't screw it up, right? The master in our parable entrusts his slaves with big portions of his wealth before skipping town, right, to worry about something else. Don't let the word talent fool you. This parable is about money, lots of money. Different sources suggest different amounts, right? One talent could be anywhere from between a few months of wages to a lifetime's. So whether this is counted in thousands or millions, these slaves are handed lots of cash and told to take care of it. It also says that they're being given these differing amounts based on their ability, but it doesn't define ability or how it's measured. But we do know that the master is the one lending his cash out. So he's the one deciding who is the most talented steward. But I tend to think the master may be an unreliable narrator. I often think that we'd understand Jesus' parables better if we were Jewish. I mean, the central action of this story is in this response to the action that's taking place outside of the story, both before the story starts, who is this wealthy landowner, right? And what happens after the master leaves and before he gets back. And this is nearly as important. Jewish hearers of the time would know some things that we don't readily. They'd know that taking interest was forbidden by God. And they'd also be aware that money is made by taking it from someone else. So making money off of the poor was tantamount to extortion. It seems to me that Jewish hearers of this parable would be quite horrified in the telling. When the first two slaves are rewarded for breaking the law and stealing from their neighbors, and the one who keeps the law is punished. Perhaps we should hear that too. When I step into the pulpit or into your living room, I'm entrusted with your attention and entrusted with the gospel and entrusted with tradition. It sometimes feels like a barbell on my shoulders, or else a dove. And to tell the truth, I don't know which is heavier. Of all the things we take from Scripture, I hope we take a minute, just a fraction of our time, to pause on this fact that so many of these parables are about slaves. Jesus teaches his followers with stories of people with no freedom, no power, and no money. The whole setup for this story is that these slaves are entrusted with someone else's money. And then, in the end, two of them are celebrated. Their reward? More responsibility for someone else's money. They don't get the money, right? They have no talents. It means they are talentless. And they remain untalented. Scholars believe that the evangelist we call Matthew was writing to a Jewish community. So if he wrote to us and we were good Jews, we'd hear this as another reminder that all of this is God's. We don't really own anything. Perhaps none of us needs the talents for ourselves, since all are God's. We just get to play with them for a little while. Then, in the end, we'll be untalented too. This parable calls back to chapter 13, which we know as the parable of the sower. And there he casts the seeds all over the place. And some of them turn out. Right? And to be honest, it isn't a parable that makes God look very good. But in the telling, it also doesn't make Jesus look very good either. Not nearly as generous as we'd like. There, like we hear in all of these parables that we've been hearing lately, Jesus divides us, the good from the bad, the harvest from the weeds, the sheep from the goats, yes. But that relies on a dispassionate judge, unwilling to put his thumb on the scale. An image of a Jesus who doesn't care to show mercy at all. It's just how it goes. Not once or 77 times. If it's predetermined, then it doesn't matter. No different than condemning each other of us for our DNA or our melanin, right? Our upbringing, creed, ability, all the ways that we're unique, beautiful, I mean, even talent. These things become the predictive sort, right? In or out. Like our fate is in or out of his hands. But what good is a judge with no discretion? How can we forgive 77 times like God if there is no forgiveness? Frederick Dale Bruner believes one talent is a lifetime's wages, one talent, right? So imagine you are that slave. The master hands you one talent and is then out the door. It isn't just money then, is it? This is your whole life in your hands. What do? I mean, aren't you thinking somewhere in the back of your mind, don't screw this up? For weeks, all of these parables have felt so odd, right? I'm starting to think that this Gospel of Matthew reads like a semester-long class. The instructor sets the groundwork in the first half and then invites us to implement what we've learned in the second half. The Sermon on the Mount comes out in this passion play in a few chapters. Turn the other cheek, sorting and fruit growing. Now we're here, the rubber is peeling against the road, everything swimming in our brains, the cliff notes, the executive summary in hand, we need to cram for the exam, right? What is it that Jesus wants us to know? Boil it down. Love. It's love, isn't it? And the rest of it but noise? So what if we're supposed to be reading these parables like this? I know God is love, first. And we love our neighbors and look out for them as much as we look out for ourselves. And we stand up to injustice, etc. So given that, how does this compare to God's kingdom vision? I'm thinking of it like a puzzle or a word search, like find love in there. Look for joy and hope. Where is shalom, right? And peace with justice? Where is it in there? What does our understanding of God's vision do to this parable? Does it make it plainly seen? Or is the kingdom instead revealed in the unseen for those with ears to hear and eyes to see? Is the central thesis so plain? Can we find the point only in the first half, born of our longing to please God? Or is it in the end, in the punishing visage of a tyrannical deity? Perhaps the thesis is more hidden and only visible to those who've seen more of it before. Then we'd be able to see beyond this anti-kingdom vision to the real thing, so we can apply what we already know. That sorting isn't about our nature or our actions, but our willingness to love. That love is generous and sacrificial and free. Can we see past this example of stewardship of resources to one that is more generous and just? A window shade drawn to the warm sun from this chilly room. This window to see out may also provide our escape from the cold. The abiding challenge of our faith is that we insist on practicing it alone. Despite the apostles sent in pairs, we make like bridesmaids with our lamps and reject the easiest notion that we can gather our light together. Once again, the master divides his estate between individuals, and the vile master keeps them divided like the southern slave owner after slavery is abolished, playing favorites. He gives the one enough power to hate the other. Easily divided, easily conquered. That is not the kingdom. We are the children of the kingdom. And our currency is love. The kingdom is for all of us, the talented and the talentless. And we don't buy it or fund it with talent. We find it with love. Building, creating, bringing it together.